This is Cave Scott Allen of otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded February 20, 2015, and today we're talking to Amit Alp-Balkan. So Amit, you're on the Azure Linux team, correct?
That's right.
Okay, so we'll be talking about that and also the work you've been doing with Docker and Windows and Docker images and all that stuff. So first of all, you're on the Azure Linux team. What is that like? What's it like being on a Linux team at Microsoft?
Oh, yeah. So that's a relatively newly formed team. Right now, we are not actually the guys running Linux on Azure. So when you create a Linux VM, we're not doing that. But it's rather we're starting to host our new services in Linux. So, for example, yesterday or the day before that, on Wednesday, I believe we announced that we launched Azure HD Insights. So that's a service entirely running on Linux. So right now we are starting to create Linux services and offering them as an Azure service. So right now we're trying to provide the infrastructure and basically the Linux image and other Linux related tools for these teams internally. But as a side thing, we're also doing open source such as Docker and other things. That's basically what we do here. It feels really good since we started to do more of open source in, well, pretty much everywhere in the company. Well, it's certainly exciting. You get a chance to reach out to other developers from other companies. I can tell it's really fun.
So I'm looking at your LinkedIn and stuff. Like, you've been working on Linux and cross-platform stuff for a while, right? Like, you were doing stuff back in university and through your earlier jobs.
I guess I'm pretty much a Unix tech guy already. I don't really use Windows on a daily basis.
Okay. Cool. I guess the only other question I've got on that is, like, is it weird when you talk to other people at Microsoft, like, you know, or like, is there weird legal stuff you guys have to jump through in order to be doing open source Linux contributing? Like, I guess you're not contributing directly to Linux, just more to like to Docker kind of stuff, right?
That's correct. Yeah. As a matter of fact, you know, it's not really a surprise to people when you talk and say, okay, I do open source at Microsoft, even for Microsoft employees. It's more like there are certain things that we should go through at least a legal process to, you know, get approved to work on. For example, Linux kernel is one of them. I mean, most GPL licensed code is still a gray area, or at least a red area, you know, because it's kind of dangerous to get influence from that. But mostly, you know, doing open source is just fine. I mean, we started to do open source without even getting permission. I mean, I release some personal repos all the time because they are pretty much harmless, and we do contribute to Docker. As a matter of fact, we have gone through a legal procedure to contribute to Docker because it's a relatively new technology, the container stuff, and we might have certain patents about those. So we've gone through that, and it was really simple, fast, and we just started to do coding right away.
Okay.
Yeah.
So would you like, I guess, first of all, we haven't had anyone on the show to talk about Docker before. We've kind of, I don't know, I talked about what I thought it was, and then people in comments told me I was completely wrong. And then I talked to Kenji at Spoon, which is kind of a containerization thing for Windows. But can you describe for me, like, my kind of half understanding of Docker is that, like, with a VM kind of virtualization system, you've got a guest operating system, whereas with Docker you've got containers which don't have a separate guest. They kind of run on top of the host OS. Is that about right?
That's totally correct. Yeah.
Okay. Like, how would you describe Docker to somebody who hasn't used it before?
Yeah. It's relatively harder to explain to people with Windows background. So here's what I think it is. So Docker is something it's basically a box that you put your application inside it, and when it goes to the other side, let's say to the cloud or your server in your on-premise, when the package is opened up, it can run exactly the same way it was running on your machine. So what it does is it basically creates an image out of your application, and it goes to, let's say, some Linux VM, or it doesn't have to be a VM. It could be a physical machine as well. So it goes to VM. It basically creates a sandbox, like an application sandbox, and it just puts your files in it, and it starts your application. And you can say that there is a certain security boundary so that it cannot see what other containers are doing or their files. So it's a semi-secure boundary to run multiple things on one machine. And what Docker does is it makes it really easy to, you know, get your application package from your computer and deliver to cloud. I guess that pretty much explains it. I mean,
okay. So, and what's been explained to me is that because Linux kind of has this everything is a file kind of thing, where like if you talk to a device, it's sort of like you're writing to a file, that it's a little bit easier to do that, like to isolate things on Linux as opposed to Windows.
That's totally right. So what Docker does is it creates a file system on the Linux machine. By the way, let me say this upfront. So Docker currently works against Linux hosts only. So Windows and Hyper-V teams are working on getting Docker ready for next release of Windows Server containers. That's when actually we will be able to use Windows containers. So what we're doing is right now we're just creating a command line we're porting the command line interface of Docker, but eventually the containers are going to run on Linux today. But in the future, we are going to be running the containers on Windows as well. So what Docker does is it creates a file system. It mounts that file system into the container, and it basically creates, there's this notion of namespaces in Linux. So for example, you're saying that, okay, there is this C drive on Windows, right? And when I go to C/Windows, you know, everybody's going to see the same thing. But if I create a container, everybody is going to get their own version of file system. So it's not really like they are sharing anything. That's why it's like a VM. So if you, you know, I don't know, for example, let's say there can be two containers on one physical machine listening on port 80, because the container thinks, okay, I'm the only guy running on this VM and I am listening to port 80 because there is no other processes I can see. And another container might be thinking of the same thing, but they're actually mapped to some other host port that is not port 80. So this is basically the Linux namespace thing. So at the same, you know, I could be mounting same file names. I could be using same, I don't know, volume names or file descriptors in different containers, and they won't notice that they are running on the same machine. And the container actually thinks it's the only guy running on that machine, just like a VM.
Okay. But different from a VM, because there's not a whole separate operating system. It's just kind of a, like that namespacing thing. Containers are really small and light and quick to start up and create and stuff, right?
That's totally right. Yeah. I mean, a container is just another process on top of the host operating system, and by host operating system, it can still be a VM, but in this case, I'm going to call it host operating system. When you create a container, it's just an invisible boundary. You can call it a security boundary, but the processes running inside the container are actually directly running on the host kernel. So host kernel gets to schedule which process is going to run directly. So there is actually much less overhead than the VMs. And for example, the best thing I like about containers is, you know, you can create 100 containers on one physical machine or one VM, but you cannot really create 100 VMs on one machine because one VM probably has 20 gigs of disk, right? I mean, it mm-hmm. comes with the entire operating system. So it's really efficient to have containers. And as you said, you know, they spin up really fast.
Okay. Yeah, like I've seen some demos with that where, you know, they'll script it out and spin up like 20 Docker images in a few seconds.
Yep.
Okay, K. Scott?
Just trying to compare this with the experience that I have on some Linux systems, which is maybe if I'm writing a Ruby on Rails app and I have gem files and I know it's going to be deployed with Apache running under Passenger and all that stuff, So the traditional way to deploy that would be to get all the source code files over and gem install or bundle install. I guess with containers, what you're saying is you could just build a container that has all those environment settings and binaries, or it describes all those?
So there are actually two ways of building a Docker container. One of them really fits for your use case. So in one case, what you do is you just copy all your built binaries or dependencies into a container, and then you ship the container. But that's not really the good way, because it's like, you know, the old FTP way of doing things. You're just copying things over there. But so there is this another way called building using Dockerfile. So you can create a script file, which something looks like a make file, but it's more sane and easy to understand. And in that file, you basically say, okay, just copy the source code, and I'm going to use Ruby as my base image. There's probably some image called Ruby in Docker, so it's an official language image. It has the Ruby runtime, just you need it. So you just copy your application, and you can say, okay, run, I don't know, gem install this, 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 and it will download the dependencies for you. And then you can say, okay, here is the entry point. For example, server.ruby, right? So then you can just start the server. I mean, what it's going to do is, for example, while building the container, it's going to execute all these steps. And after executing these steps, there's going to be a file system, and it will create an image out of that div in the file system. So it is not going to be the entire image. It is going to be a div on top of the Ruby image. And then, you know, the entry point is the server you are going to start. So then when you ship the container to your VM or to cloud, doesn't matter, it's going to start the container. What it is going to do is it will basically unpack all the installed things into a path in the file system, actually the path you desired, for example, /app on Linux. And then it's just going to invoke the web server, and the web server will be up for you. I mean, it really makes things easier that way.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I guess the most interesting part of that to me was that you can set up sort of an inheritance hierarchy of containers.
Yeah, that's totally right. I mean, what you usually do is you don't really start building things on an Ubuntu image. There are a set of official base images for Docker, and those are stuff like base OS images like BusyBox, Ubuntu, Debian, stuff like that. And there are certain language runtimes. For example, there is Python, there is ASP.NET, there is Ruby, etc. So what you can do is, if your application is like a, I don't know, some sort of interpreted language thing that is not compiled, what you can do is you can just put your source code in there, and you can just say, okay, Python, run this script for me. And it's just going to make use of existing Python image. It will just add certain things on top of the base Python image, and it will create a layer using div out of that image. And probably your div is going to be just, you know, as big as your application. It's not going to be like gigs or several hundred of megs.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Just to dig into that a little bit more. So, people always say these, you know, the containers are independent. But if you're doing something like, you've got a Ruby container, and then you've got an app that's written in Ruby, and that is using the Ruby container, like that seems to imply some sort of, you know, communication between the two layers. You know what I mean? Like the code that's running in the Ruby container needs to talk to the code that's running in the app. So, how does that work? You know, do you understand what I'm asking?
Please correct me if I'm wrong. You're saying, okay, you have this base Ruby image, and you have the Ruby application image, and the application image contains your source code or whatever, but how is it going to communicate back to Ruby, right?
Exactly.
So what it does is, okay, so when you say my base image is Ruby, Docker is going to extract all the Ruby image into a directory or into a file system on Linux, and then it will basically apply the div, which is your application image. If your application image says, for example, delete this file on the base container, but add these files as well. So what Docker does is it will basically apply whatever you say. So in this case, it will basically just put your application into the base container, which is the Ruby image, and then create a file system out of it. So at the end, you will have a container that has Ruby plus your application image. So the Ruby binaries will be locally working.
I see.
Yeah.
And now if you want to say like upgrade the version of Ruby that you're working with, you're then like basically creating a new container that has the new Ruby and then your binaries applied to it.
Yeah. So another paradigm that Docker is trying to impose on the way people deploy things is basically they're trying to create immutable deployment units. They don't really want containers to be, you know, something people SSH or login into and do upgrades, because containers are really, you know, cheap things that you can kill and spin up in a second. So what Docker wants to impose on people is, okay, you got this Ruby container. If you want to upgrade it, just change the, you know, version number of the base image and then rebuild your application container, then deploy it. Basically, this way, you will always have the same thing reproducible. And when you try to log into the container and start to change things, you are basically breaking the nature of immutability over there, and you're creating something that is not exactly reproducible. Because when you start to change things by logging into a container, that container is no longer working the way it was working on your development machine. So if you want to really change the version of Ruby, what you do is you change the base image. For example, I don't really know the Ruby versions, but if you say, okay, try stop using version A and use version B instead, and then if you rebuild your image, if you test it on your development machine, if it works, and then you can just deploy the same thing to the cloud. And what it's going to do is it will download the new layers regarding Ruby, and it will download your image as well to the server, and it will spin up the container, and it will work exactly the same way it was working on your machine. So in a way, Docker provides this reproducibility, and which makes, you know, things really easy to debug. If something is failing on your cloud machine, it's probably failing on your development machine as well.
What about when there are differences, like, you know, configuration settings for mail servers and databases and things?
Yeah, there is nothing to do about that, right? I mean, there is that, but this usually helps with, you know, so here's the thing. Today, the people set up Linux servers is they SSH into some Linux machine. They install some dependencies, right? And if you have a development machine, what you're trying to do is you're probably maybe using Vagrant or not, or stuff like that, or Packer, Chef, Puppet. But if you're not really using those stuff, you may end up getting different version of different, you know, dependencies. And if that happens to be the case, you're trying to, you know, I don't know, it's kind of risky. You'll probably start getting some weird errors and you won't be able to reproduce the exact same thing on your development machine, because the thing is, they are not really the exact same file systems. So when you deploy the container, the exact same snapshot of the file system appears over there on the server. That's what makes it kind of reproducible.
I'm wondering how this will ever get running on Windows with things like with the Windows registry.
Yeah, I really wonder about that too. Actually, I believe, you know, as Windows container stuff start to light up, maybe later this year, people are going to start talking about it. I mean, I'm really curious about that too. I don't really know how it's going to work out, but I'm pretty sure Windows guys are going to make it work. Because, you know, in Linux, everything is a file. If you can talk to the file, if you can create a file system out of it, you know, you're pretty much done. You don't need to talk to anything on the side. But on Windows, there is, I don't know, COM APIs, there is registry, there is probably other stuff that we don't know about. I mean, so you can actually tell the difference that people are going to move to some, I mean, a more containerized world, because .NET folks started to implement the .NET version, you know, which is not using registry. I mean, it's running on Mac and Linux. So it's not really using registry or some hard-coded paths or stuff like that anymore. You can just have the runtime as a base image, and then it will all use files as configuration things.
I mean, that's probably a pretty good segue.
Yeah, that's true. Well, go ahead. I was just going to say, you know, we did talk to I talked to Kenji over at Spoon, and they were doing this kind of registry redirection stuff. And I mean, I played with Spoon and like was able to, you know, run all kinds of different things and install things on different Windows containers, and it was all abstracted out, and he explained like the registry redirection stuff. And I know other things have done that too. There's ways to get in and just kind of have a virtual registry.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a virtual registry at the end, I guess. If people probably what's going to happen is people are going to have a base Windows image where the appropriate registry keys are set, and on top of those, there will be a set of registry settings that is part of the Docker image. And if I just want to change the setting, I just add my registry key and value over there. And when the container is going to be started, Windows just takes the registry input from the Docker image manifest or metadata, and it will just apply it to the host, as you said, maybe some virtual registry.
So, but one big thing this points out is that because of like the my image is running on top of a base image, and so like that, I'm not going to be able to take a Windows, like a Docker image built on Windows and copy it over to a Linux machine, right? They're not portable. They're just, they run on top. As long as everything is the same running underneath them, they're going to work. But I can't copy between different operating systems, correct?
Yeah, you're totally right. I mean, Linux images are going to work on Linux, and Windows images are going to work on Windows. That's pretty much how it's going to work out.
Okay. So you worked on creating some Docker images like for ASP.NET 5 running in a Linux container, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So what's involved with that? Like, how did you go about doing that?
So I was in a product team before this in Azure. It was some internal product probably nobody knows about running the infrastructure. So I was kind of bored, and I was seeing this Docker stuff on Hacker News, and I thought, okay, you know what? There's this cool new ASP.NET vNext, and I thought maybe we can run this thing on, you know, Linux containers using Mono or something. And I knew that there's Mono support for ASP.NET vNext, and there was this Mono support in its early stages, so I just made use of that. I created an image, and, you know, the following few months has been basically, you know, following up on political things, you know, legal approvals. But, you know, after like 6 months, I guess we were able to release the Microsoft's first Docker image on October last year. So it's kind of great. I mean, people don't really expect .NET to work on Linux. And, you know, since we have this official .NET runtime coming to official .NET runtime coming to Linux and Mac, I guess we will just, you know, swap the Mono thing out of it, and we will just plug the .NET, and it will work the exact same way. I mean, it's kind of exciting. I think even I can use that because, you know, I write some applications in .NET from time to time, and I'm using Mono. So if I can get the same way, you know, writing applications in my Mac, and if I can deploy the same thing to Linux, and if that's a .NET image, I mean, that's the perfect match, I think.
So this might go a little too deep, but so one of the things I've wondered about is what's the difference in terms of at least running on a Linux container. What's the difference between a Docker image running and something running in like user mode?
Well, Docker containers are actually running in user mode. Docker image is just basically a tar file. I mean, Docker image is basically a zip file, and it gets, you know, copied from your machine to the Linux server, and then it gets basically unarchived, unzipped, if you will. And then when it's unzipped, it gets extracted to some directory, and that directory becomes the root file system of our container. And the processes are directly running in user mode.
Oh, so they don't, trying to think of how to phrase this. It's not that the access to the underlying hardware and kernel stuff is virtualized. It's just that it's running in user mode, and it's more of a sandboxing thing than an actual process isolation, I guess. Would that be one way to say it?
Totally, you're totally right. I mean, this is not a hardware virtualization thing. It is more like a sandbox. Okay, what containers does is they create an invisible boundary that we put the applications in, and every process you run inside that boundary will think, okay, I'm the only process running inside this machine, right? I mean, if a process wants to be process ID 5, it very well can be, but there can be another process ID 5 in another container. But these stuff somehow, you know, using the Linux namespaces, they get mapped to different process IDs, but the containers are still thinking, okay, we're both listening on port 80, or we're both process ID 5, and they don't really know about it. I mean, it's just, there's an invisible boundary, and both are running on user file system.
So does the host operating system, or whatever you call it in this world, does it have visibility into what's going on in the different containers? Can it look at, like, enumerate all the containers and all the process fives running in all the containers and do stuff with them?
Yeah, if you have access to the host operating system, then you can pretty much, you know, list the containers, delete the containers, or, you know, get inside the container namespace and see the files or, you know, secrets related to its file system. I mean, if you have access to the host, then you can pretty much access to the container. So that's why, you know, the current state of containers is cloud services are not putting multiple customer containers into one VM. So it's rather, okay, I have, like, let's say 5 VMs on Azure, and I'm going to just put my containers in these VMs. It's not like, you know, we are sharing VMs with other customers. So there is no multi-tenancy.
Were there any technological hurdles on putting together this container for ASP.NET 5?
Well, are you asking technical difficulties about that? Or
just in general, were there any hurdles?
Well, I mean, so first of all, it's using Mono. It's not really, you know, Mono is good, but, you know, it's not the rock-solid .NET runtime you would deploy to production for your, I don't know, high-volume traffic website or anything. So we're probably going to be replacing that with the official .NET runtime when it goes out, I don't know, in a few months, I guess. And other than that, I can't really see, I mean, it's been a good process developing that container and open sourcing it. ASP.NET folks were really helpful getting the image out and making the, you know, announcement about it. I mean, I'm really grateful. And I wasn't actually working for Azure Linux team or ASP.NET team while developing this image. And that's why, you know, we were able to work with these guys, even though we're not in a, you know, close team or anything.
And then from looking at your post, I mean, it actually seems kind of simple that, you know, like you create the container, and then there's a Docker file where you expose the ports, you open up port 5004 to Kestrel. And then from then on out, you're just kind of working in, like, you treat that machine like you would just treat a normal host operating system. You go and install software, you get it all running, and then you have, then your container's set up. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much the Dockerfile thing is basically a way to script the installation of the environment. And the good thing about Dockerfile is, it gets cached. For example, if you change your application, you don't really need to, you know, wait 10 minutes to rebuild the image. It is just, you know, in a matter of seconds, your application image will be ready. And when you deploy it to the cloud, it will be spinning up very fast. And as a matter of fact, you know, the Docker containers are, another reason Docker containers are spinning up really fast is if you have the application image or the base image, you know, or at least some layers of that image downloaded already on the host machine, adding new images are rather easy. So, for example, okay, I have this ASP.NET base image, and I'm going to add application, let's say my blog on it. And if I build my blog container, and if I build my, I don't know, web API container, since both of them are using the ASP.NET image, it's just fine to, you know, what Docker is going to do is it is going to download the ASP.NET base image only once, and only the div part is going to be transferred to the cloud. I mean, that's why it's really fast, and you can treat the entire Docker container as your file system. For example, I can just go and, you know, remove the root directory. I can say rm-rf/, and it is perfectly safe inside the container because it's not really deleting anything outside the container. And I mean, this kind of gives you a safe development environment as well. If you run everything inside the container, you are not really installing anything on your host machine as well. I mean, for example, on my daily development cycle, I'm not really installing Python, Go, or Ruby on my machine. I'm just installing some text editor, and I'm installing Docker, and any change I do, it gets built in a Docker image, and the container runs on my, you know, development machine, and I can just test my application right away, and then if I'm confident with it, I'll just deploy it to the cloud. I mean, I'm not installing Ruby or anything. That's not really necessary in this case.
So there you pointed out like some different ways to get started. Like say I'm working on Windows and I want to use Docker. So one is I've seen this boot to Docker where I can install Docker running locally, but it's really just using VirtualBox and, yeah. And it's kind of running that. Or like you're saying, I can just spin up a Docker image on a, like I could run a virtual machine with Ubuntu, or I could just do it in a cloud. I could spin up a cloud instance, and because it's so lightweight what I'm installing that it doesn't take a lot of back and forth to upload, because otherwise like working with a VM in the cloud, you're uploading a huge virtual disk image, right? And you don't have to do that here.
Totally. I mean, so what boot to Docker currently does is it, as you said, you know, spins up a local VM in VirtualBox, and you know, you SSH into that VirtualBox VM to use Docker. So what we're trying to do is, I'm actually currently working on that. You are just going to install boot to Docker. It will create a VM on your VirtualBox anyway, but you will get a nice Docker exe command, and you'll be able to, you know, talk to Docker directly from your Windows development environment. So if you're running you're developing an ASP.NET application in Visual Studio, you'll be just able to call Docker EXE and you'll be able to build the ASP.NET application container, and that thing will run on, you know, boot to Docker VM, or it will run on your cloud instance the same way. So you can test your changes locally by deploying to that boot to Docker VM, or then you can deploy it to the cloud instance if you're just confident with it.
So you've been working on porting the Docker command line to Windows. So as I understand it, the idea is that I can't copy my images back and forth, but I can use the same Docker commands I'm familiar with and Docker infrastructure and stuff on both a Windows and a Linux machine. So, and you're working on this command line stuff so that I can do, you know, whatever Docker create or something on my Windows machine. Is that right?
Yeah, that's totally right. I mean, what we're trying to bring is, okay, you cannot run the Windows, you cannot host the Windows containers on your Windows machine today, but why not just use the Linux VMs you have? I mean, or when the Linux containers stuff, you know, come up later on, you'll be able to use this Docker command line interface to talk to any other Docker host instance. So I'm referring to that as Docker host, and Docker host is what basically listens to some port on some remote machine, and it's going to accept the requests, and it's going to create the containers or, you know, download the images accordingly. So that work kind of involves, so the Docker is a project that is entirely written in Go, and I personally like Go very much. I mean, you can cross-compile binaries, and for example, the same code compiles for Linux, Mac, and Windows exactly the same way. So what we're doing is there are certain dependencies and requirements that, you know, so the Docker was developed with the assumption that, okay, this thing is going to run only on Linux. And that's why there's a lot of, you know, hard-coded Linux assumptions in there. There's Linux-related dependencies. And what we're trying to do is we're basically cutting out these dependencies, and we're trying to get it compiling and working correctly on your Windows machine as well. So if you are developing a, let's say, Python application, you know, Python runs on Windows and Linux very well. I mean, you can just deploy your Python application on Windows, and you can package it into a Docker image on Windows, and then you can deliver it to the Docker host. That is today Linux, but tomorrow it can be Windows as well.
Is that difficult, the work that you're doing on that?
Well, I mean, I don't know how to answer that. I mean, it's not really trivial, but it is... it's a bit non-trivial, I guess. I mean, so there are certain behavior like, Docker expects to see, you know, some Linux-related things in its environment, and we're trying to find their Windows equivalents. For example, today I'm gonna, I guess, work on this problem. So the problem is when you package an image from Mac or Linux, there is this read, write, execute bits on the file. And there is, you know, there is a concept of owner and group, right, on Linux and Mac. But there is no such concepts on, well, Windows. But and another thing is, since we're using Go, Go is not really implementing the entire Windows Win32 APIs. And there are certain limitations on what we can do. So we're trying to find a middle ground between, you know, making everything rock solid work for Windows and basically, I don't know, I guess we're just trying to, you know, find the middle ground between getting things correctly working on Windows. I mean, there are certain things that can take longer time. For example, I'm planning to write the missing functionality of the Go language for Win32 APIs. I guess we'll add, for example, there is no support for symbolic links in Go language if you're running on Windows. But Windows actually has symbolic links. So we're trying to implement some of those stuff.
Guys, any other questions on like Windows support for Docker or this stuff?
No, it's exciting to see this kind of stuff migrating to other platforms. Still kind of a pain to get working under Mac, from what I understand. But all the cool kids have moved on to other things anyway, besides Macs now, right? So the idea of being able to, you know, spin up a Docker container, write whatever code you want to put in there, whether it's ASP.vnext or Ruby, Python, or some combination of three, and kind of have this self-contained configuration, kind of like the old Smalltalk images, where you would just write all the code in this little image and then deploy that to your image host when you wanted to, you know, deploy to production, so to speak. But being able to take this and then move it to either, you know, a local production server or test server, and then, you know, just shove the same kind of container up to Azure eventually without having to, you know, change a lot of configuration or, you know, twiddle a lot of bits is really kind of a blessing to those of us who have to deal in gargantuan release processes, I guess I would say.
Kevin?
So I've been reading some blog posts recently about people talking about how running Docker in production is a little bit trickier than running it in development. And that the people are still kind of figuring that piece of it out, dealing with things like aggregating logs, and there seems like there have been a few issues around that. I was wondering if you had any experience with any of that and had any comments.
Yeah, I can probably talk about that. So if you look at the Docker ecosystem right now, what people are doing is mostly, I mean, the guys running Docker in production are trying to build an orchestration system around it. So there are certain projects, like, for example, Google has Kubernetes, and there are other orchestrator tools like Mesosphere, or Docker is going to come up with something called Docker Swarm. So what these guys are basically gonna do is, okay, I have these set of VMs, you know, and I'm going to deploy this container, and I want three instances of this container, you know, and this container requires a gig of RAM and two CPU cores, you know, to just go and find some place that where I can happily live. And what Orchestrator does is basically, you know, it has all the list of these instances, VM instances you have, and you just talk to the Orchestrator, and Orchestrator basically finds some place for you. And when the containers are deployed, if the instance dies or anything, it basically service heals your container, you know, it brings them up in some other place. This is in a way that what, you know, this is the managed hosting, right? I mean, if you deploy an Azure VM, if the host machine dies in the data center, we basically find another place for you, for your VM to live, and we just bring your VM up in some other place. We basically service heal you. So the problem is most of these orchestrators are still in their baby steps. I mean, there is not really an enterprise-grade, rock-solid orchestrator in Docker area. And, you know, people are basically trying to come up with their own stuff. And, you know, I guess there are more people working on developing Docker than people using it actually in production. So it's still a new technology, although it came out, I guess, in early 2013, but it really became popular over the last year. And, you know, it's still something going on. And, you know, I guess when the orchestrator stuff, you know, becomes more mature and stable, I believe people are going to start using those orchestrators. And when you start talking to an orchestrator, your job is basically much more easier. I mean, it can, let's say, okay, let's put it in this way. So you'll be able to bundle your containers together using these orchestrators. And if you're going to say, okay, I want these containers to be co-located on the same machine, and I want a log aggregator next to them, you'll be able to deploy all these all together. So this kind of gives you a control over, you know, how you manage things. We don't want people to go talk to VMs individually, and we don't want people to not care or know, you know, which container is running where. Because, and another thing is actually the service discovery stuff. Let's say I have my blog, but my blog uses Memcache or Redis, and I have these Memcache and Redis containers also deployed in, I don't know, some of my VMs, but I don't exactly know which VMs are those, and I need to figure out some dynamic way to, you know, hit those Redis or Memcache instances. So there are also, you know, some like DNS solutions and automatic discovery solutions being built at the moment. But Docker also has this container linking feature. So, for example, if I'm deploying a container called A and another container called B, I can talk from container A to container B just by using A and B. I can just say http://A, and I will be hitting the other container. So Docker is trying to provide some nice tooling around service discovery as well, but I can tell that more stuff will come about this because everybody is kind of working crazy about this. What it does is basically, okay, let's say you are basically creating 100 instances on Azure. That is now your data center. Or let's say you have 50 physical machines in your on-premise data center. This is your data center, and people are trying to build, if you call, like data center operating systems. And when, you know, this data center operating system thing comes up, you will be able to just talk to your data center just like it is your cloud. And in a way that, you know, since, you know, you can create 100 instances on Azure, I mean, we are actually managing the physical machines, and we are managing the health of your VMs for you. But, you know, you can create these 100 VMs, and then you can decide, okay, which container lives where, or you can decide on the scheduler, you know, what algorithm you are going to use for scheduling. Are you going to pre-allocate? How are you going to offer your resources to the scheduler? So there are certain non-trivial problems in that area, I guess. But people are working really hard to solve that. It's not just Docker people. There are other companies and other startups working on the same problem. You know, the orchestration of the containers is really a big deal, I guess.
This reminds me of something Scott Kuhn mentioned before, which is the Apache Mesos project.
Yeah, Mesos is one of those schedulers. So Mesos is basically, it is a very battle-tested scheduler. I'm not going to call it scheduler. It's more of like an orchestrator, and you can plug different schedulers in it. And there's this there's this startup in San Francisco called Mesosphere. So they're building really cool tooling around Mesos project. So what it does is basically you can send your tasks to Mesos, and it can, you know, what it does is it can run those tasks on your set of machines, set of slave machines, if you will. But those, you know, execution systems, you can also configure how the application is going to run. If you want to run the application in a container, Mesos can just, you know, take your application and put it in a container and then spin up in some VM. So there are like schedulers, for example, called Marathon. So Marathon is a very popular scheduler for Mesosphere. What it does is basically it will, if you say, okay, I have this container, just deploy three instances of this somewhere and keep it alive. It will, you know, watch your slaves. It will deploy your containers. And if the container dies, if it can't get heartbeat or anything, it will redeploy your container to somewhere else. So Mesos is like you know, one of those data center operating system things, really.
Cool. The work with orchestration on Azure would be similar to that then?
So the current strategy we've been following is we want to play really good with all the orchestrators out there. I mean, we're not providing any native container scheduling. On the other hand, for example, Google has Google Container Engine, and their Amazon has, I guess, EC2 Container Service. So what you do in this case is you basically go to the portal and you create, I want 1 terabyte of RAM and this many CPU cores, and it creates the VMs for you. And you'll end up, let's say, with 50 VMs. And then you talk to some orchestrator. In Google case, it is Kubernetes. And in Amazon case, there is a proprietary orchestrator you talk to. And you don't really get to see what's running inside the VMs. I mean, you can see, but you don't really want to do that. So what we currently do in Azure is, you know, users can come and set up their own orchestrators. They can set up Docker Swarm. They can set up Google's Kubernetes, or they can set up, I don't know, Mesosphere. If they really want to do that, we totally support this. But I'm not sure if we have any plans for releasing any, you know, Azure native orchestration offering at the moment.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'm about out of questions. Any other questions, guys? Or Ahmed, anything that we missed you'd like to mention?
I guess I can't think of any.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for your time. I definitely feel like I've learned quite a bit,
I'm very glad. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Cool. All right. That's all the time we have this week on Herding Code. So thanks a bunch, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.